Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. This morning, for Mother's Day weekend, we are going to be looking at some mothers whom perhaps the public is not really that attuned to thinking about. And among those mothers is Marissa Alexander, who is the woman who fired the gunshot into the air to protect herself from her husband, who was attacking her. And now she is out under house arrest, but she was actually prosecuted for that. And the whole thing around standing one's ground, we think about what happened to Trayvon Martin, also in Florida, and the person who shot him, you know, is walking around afterwards after, you know, killing that child in cold-blooded murder. And this Black woman who didn't kill anyone, didn't shoot anyone, just trying to protect herself, was prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So we are joined in the studio. I'm not certain if it's Helen or Alisa. Good morning. Uh-oh. Well, there's neither one of the women is joining us presently. So we are going to be joined in the studio by two women, Alisa Beria, and she's an organizer with the Free Marissa Now Mobilization Campaign and a member of the National Feminist of Color Network, Insight. She's also the Associate Director of the Center for Race and Gender at UC Berkeley and a PhD candidate at Stanford University, based currently in the San Francisco Bay Area. And Helen Gilbert helped found the Free Marissa Now and the Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander. And Helen is Seattle-based activist and leader of the Radical Women, a national multiracial socialist feminist organization, which also has a chapter in the Bay Area. So while we wait for them to join us, I am going to play something from Sweet Honey in the Rock. Sort of get us in the mood here. Oh, that might be one of our guests. Hi, is this Alisa?
It is.
Okay, great, because I was waiting for you all to call in. I was going to play some music. I've already introduced you. And for some reason, Helen hasn't joined us yet.
No, this is Helen.
Oh, Helen, you didn't say anything.
I'm sorry, you didn't hear me. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I introduced you. So you heard me introduce you and everything, right?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, okay, no problem. Okay, great. So both you and Alisa are in the studio. You can say hi to each other if you like.
Good morning, Alisa.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good.
Okay, so why don't you tell us about Marissa's case? Why don't you start, Helen, since you founded the Free Marissa Now organization, and talk about what's happening this weekend. And then, Alisa, you've founded some great organizations that I know of personally, and then you could talk about maybe the whole plight of and the effect of imprisonment on mothers and their children.
Okay, so this is Helen. Free Marissa Now got going when Sumaya Coleman, who is with the African American Black Women's Cultural Alliance, and I from Radical Women and Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander, joined up with Alita Alston-Torre, who is a Jacksonville organizer who'd been a supporter of Marissa Alexander from the very first trial, and then teamed up with Alisa Beria from Insight. And we've been building a national campaign to free Marissa because this case is just such an appalling example of what happens to women who stand up to defend themselves, and especially if they're women of color, they're treated with little sympathy from the society and the court system. And Marissa, who you would think after having just given birth 9 days before, then being attacked, physically attacked by her abusive husband who'd put her in the hospital before and had a record of abusing a long string of women, you'd think she would be treated with sympathy when she took what action she felt she had to save her own life without injuring anyone else. But instead, the Florida court system treated her as a violent criminal and put her in jail for a 20-year sentence. They have mandatory minimum sentencing in Florida, which is having devastating effects and is really leading to mass incarceration. And so she was given a 20-year sentence for a simple act of self-defense that didn't hurt anyone, whereas we're seeing rapists, murderers, abusers around the country given much smaller sentences. Through the efforts of Free Marissa Now and Marissa's family and attorneys, we were able to get a new trial for her. The Florida Court of Appeals last fall said her first trial did not respect her rights as the victim, as innocent until proven guilty. And so she's supposed to have a new trial starting at the end of July. But what's really quite appalling in this case is that the Angela Corey, who's the state prosecutor who has allowed the murderers of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis to walk free virtually, seems to have an incomplete vendetta against Marissa Alexander and is now threatening her with a 60-year sentence if she's found guilty in the second trial. So this is something that we all need to rally behind as an issue of a woman's right to defend herself and stopping racism in the courts that are particularly vindictive and punishing toward women of color.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Alisa, why don't you maybe talk about a little bit more about Marissa and, you know, she, her, the infant that Helen was speaking of is now 3 years old, a 3-year-old daughter, and Marissa already had twin children. They're now teenagers, and the child was premature, and you already mentioned, Helen, that she and the child's father, the relationship was estranged. I mean, they weren't together. And so why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, how Marissa is doing now. Have you spoken to her, either one of you? And talk about this sort of bi-coastal or national move to assist her, because her name is not one that has prominence in the media. I mean, you don't hear a lot about her and what's going on with her. And I was wondering how her case is emblematic of what's happening with mothers throughout the nation. Quite a few women, I mean, the majority of women who are incarcerated for violent crimes are there because they were trying to defend themselves.
That's right. Well, I want to start by saying that reproductive justice issues, the experience of pregnancy and mothering is really connected to both domestic violence and to mass incarceration. And so we know that when women who are in abusive relationships are pregnant, they're more likely to experience escalating forms of abuse, and homicide is also the second leading cause of injury-related deaths in pregnant and postpartum women in the United States. So it's terrible, but it's also part of a pattern. Marissa's experience of being attacked when she was pregnant and attacked again 9 days after she gave birth is really shocking and a horrific situation, but it's also reflective of the relationship between battering and mothering. So that's one important statistic that we need to understand. And the other thing is that, as Helen said, mass incarceration is a crisis in the United States. For quite a while, black women were the fastest growing rate of people who were being incarcerated. And the majority of women behind bars are mothers. And the other thing about mothering behind bars is that women are more likely to be the primary caretakers of children. So it's not only that they're mothers, it's that when they are incarcerated, it creates such a devastation, such a destabilization of their families and the lives of their children. So these things are deeply connected, and it's important for us to understand when we think about domestic violence. We often think, oh, well, we need to increase criminalization. But in fact, what's going on is when you pass pro-criminalization policies and pro-law and order policies, those policies often have an impact on vulnerable victims and survivors of domestic violence. Instead of supporting Marissa as a survivor of domestic violence, what ended up happening is after she defended herself from an attack, she was arrested, prosecuted, subject to a mandatory minimum sentence, and now, you know, as Helen said, that sentence may very well be tripled if she's found guilty in her new trial this July. So we really need to think about, the relationship between racist criminalization policies in the United States and whether continuing to support them actually supports victims of gender violence. And then the other thing is, of course, thinking about the impact that racist criminalization is having on mothers in general. So, you know, all these issues are deeply intertwined. With regards to the movement to Free Marissa, it's important to Florida is, has its very particular problems, and Angela Corey does seem to be targeting Marissa in particular in ways that are frightening and confusing. there seems to be a lot of scandal and controversy surrounding Angela Corey right now, so perhaps that's why she's targeting Marissa as a way to deflect attention from her own problems. But it's really critical to understand that it's not just Corey and Florida, that mass incarceration is a national problem. The U.S. leads the world in prisoners. There are 2.5 people behind bars right now, and it's creating quite devastating consequences for communities, for families, for women and men and transgender people. So it's something that we really need to pay attention to. And instead of, undermining violence against women, it's actually creating and sustaining violence against women. So we really need to deal with it, and we need to deal with it in a movement way that's both local and national and transnational. So the movement to Free Marissa, Free Marissa Now mobilization campaign is, Helen talked about the 4 people who are in the core committee and in D.C., in Jacksonville, in Seattle, and I'm here in the Bay. But there are people who are doing that organizing all around the United States. We have a really great group in Chicago, some great people doing work in Pittsburgh. When we do different projects like mobilizing people to call Angela Corey to drop the case against Marissa, or sending Marissa cards and donations to make sure that she knows that she's not alone, that love and support and political work really comes out of all kinds of places, certainly all around the nation, but also from Australia, from Canada, from Europe, Africa. So people understand that it's really critical to Free Marissa to support, you know, in order to exercise or demonstrate our great desire to support women's right to self-defense. But also I think it's a statement against the crisis, the prison crisis in this country right now, and our need to take a stand in supporting survivors of domestic violence, especially those who are being criminalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm a member of the board for California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and we had a meeting on Wednesday. And at that meeting, we talked about a new prison that is supposed to be opening up this year. I don't know if you know the GEO Group. They signed a contract for the reactivation of a company-owned 260-bed McFarland, California facility, and it begins June 30th. It's extended from now until June 30th, 2018. And the facility is supposed to house female inmates and will provide enhanced rehabilitation, I'm quoting, and recidivism reduction programs. And GEO expects to begin the intake of inmates at the facility in the third quarter of 2014. And the facility is expected to generate approximately $9 million in annualized revenues at full occupancy. The contract also includes a provision for a 260-bed expansion, which can be exercised at the department's option within 12 months. Mm-hmm. And then you think about the closure of Valley State Prison in Chowchilla and the movement of the women from Valley State to the women's facility, which is just, you know, up the road across the street. And then moving other women throughout the state in to different counties in facilities which are not built to house prisoners for long lengthy sentences, as opposed to releasing women, because there are a lot of women that are in prison for nonviolent crimes. So, if you could talk a little bit about women being the fastest growing population in the prison system, and maybe connect Marissa's story to stories of other women that you know that are mothers that maybe you're in contact with. And then before you do that, I wanted to know if you could give people information on how they can call the state attorney general to release Marissa, and also how they could send her a card or be in touch with organizers like yourselves.
One thing that's happening today is a sidewalk information table outside Angela Corey's office in Jacksonville, Florida, to bring these issues home of the mass incarceration and how women, mothers, black mothers are being stripped from their children and their families through these jail programs. And I think, as you mentioned, if state and federal prisons weren't terrible enough, the idea of prisons for profit is even more horrifying and terrible conditions for inmates. And Free Marissa Now has a website. It's called freemarissanow.org, and that's probably the simplest way anyone can get information about how to write to Prosecutor Angela Corey, also how to send a Mother's Day card to Marissa or other women in prison who you want to honor on Mother's Day. We're asking people everywhere you can to send Mother's Day cards to Marissa. There's a P.O. box in Jacksonville, Florida, where those cards can be sent, and to remember her and other mothers mothers in prison this Mother's Day.
Can you spell the website, and can you just tell people what the address is to the P.O. box address is?
Sure. The website is Free Marissa Now, so that's FreeMarissaNow.org, and people can send Mother's Day cards to care of Marissa Alexander, to P.O. Box 23872. That's 23872, Jacksonville, Florida, 32257. And I know it would make all the difference to her to hear from people who are supporting her, because she is now in home detention, so she's very limited in her interactions with other people. It's wonderful she's out of prison, but she's under very, very restrictive conditions.
Thank you.
Also, just to add, on the website, freemarissanow.org, there are ways for you to donate to Marissa's Legal Defense Fund. And so we're really asking people on this Mother's Day week of action, which starts today, to send cards to the address that Helen gave, and also to donate to the Legal Defense Fund. The link is also at freemarissanow.org. It's really easy to find. It's right on the home page. Marissa is facing over $250,000 in legal fees for her defense trial. And that's with a legal team that is working pro bono. That's all the other expenses that they're facing. So the only way that she's going to be able to launch a very, very good and complete defense is with everyone's financial support. And, you know, people have given money donations ranging from just a few dollars to $500, $1,000. Every single donation counts. We want to see, you know, a large number of people giving whatever amount that they can, whatever they feel that they can, just as a way to show their love for Marissa and show their support for survivors of domestic violence who are being attacked by the state.
I'd ask in one of my bundles of questions if either one of you have met Marissa, and if you haven't, those on the ground in Florida, are any of the organizers, like, do any of the organizers actually know Marissa? Did they visit her while she was in prison? Do they know her children? Do they know her family? Can you speak to sort of how Marissa is doing, and what was she doing before she was, you know, incarcerated, right, you know, after having this child for defending herself?
The Free Marissa Now organizer in Jacksonville, Alita Alston Touré, has a strong relationship with Marissa's family and has, I believe, visited her in prison, and knows her kids play with Marissa's kids. I've gotten some notes from her when she was in the state prison, and she's just such a wonderful, warm person. She's like hearing from your sister or your best friend, and she just shouldn't be having to go through this horror. She had never had any problems with the law. She was working. She had a licensed gun. She had had restraining orders against her husband. So really, she's the kind of person who supposedly, you know, this doesn't happen to. But as we know, domestic violence happens in every community and every economic bracket. But I think for her as a woman of color, she probably felt isolated from some of the services that exist that aren't reaching out to women of color. And she, you know, didn't find the support she needed to be able to, to leave without these problems. But this is what happens to many, many women. It's a very difficult process to leave an abusive relationship. And I think we need to be really pushing for community programs to intervene to help women with the kind of financial assistance and support, with assistance for child care, and ways that women can leave abusive relationships and have the support they need to escape from danger. I think there was more to your question that I've forgotten.
I was wondering, could you share something from Marissa with the audience? Can you share something that she has written to you or someone else so we could just sort of hear her voice about what's going on now with her? And her, and you know, and she's back with her children, so I'm sure, you know, even though the conditions of being under house arrest are not optimal, at least she is a, you know, she does have her children with her. And how are they holding up? Because, you know, imprisonment does just affect the person who is incarcerated, affects the family.
We know she's with her two older children, the twins, not the younger child. And what we've heard from her family is that, you know, she's going through a transition. It's very difficult to, you know, go away when you have 10-year-olds and come back when you have teenagers. but that they're, you know, she's so happy to be back with her family. And I know she's feeling very supportive of this movement. She's unable at this point. She and her family are not able to talk to the press at the request of her lawyers. So we don't have direct quotes. But I know on Marissa's birthday, her mother, in September, her mother sent her greetings to the you know, international movement to free Marissa, and it was very warm. They're very warm, down to earth, and supportive people who are doing the best they can, and really, really appreciate all the help that's coming down. Her mother has become quite a spokesperson on the devastation of domestic violence.
Where is her baby? You said that her baby, now 3 years old, is not with her. Where is she?
She is in the custody of the ex-husband.
What? Really?
Yes. Who Florida courts have determined to be the victim.
Yeah. In closing, Elisa, do you want to say more about that?
About the fact that the child is in the custody of Marissa's abusive husband?
Yeah. And you can tie that into, I was reading this article in the San Francisco Bayview about Marissa Alexander, and it says, according to Barbara Bloom in her testimony before the Little Hoover Commission in 2004, approximately 70% of people in women's prisons are mothers, and a majority of them were the primary caretakers of their children before they were sent to prison. The over-policing and over-criminalization of pregnant women and mothers is becoming a major issue in this country, and the safety of mothers is at stake. And then there's also a chart that shows how between 1980 and 2010, the number of women in prison increased by 646%, 1.5 times the rate of men. So going from 15,118 to 112,797, and including women in local jails, more than 205,000. In California, we incarcerate more women than some countries. So, and I think, I don't know where Florida is in that number, but incarcerated mothers, from this article, are leaving behind children to be cared for by family members who are forced to deal with the emotional and financial strains of from the addition to their lives. But then you say that the abuser, you know, the person who attacked her, has custody of this child. That's outrageous.
Well, it is outrageous. So I think that the one thing to for listeners to really think about is, given those statistics that you outlined, we really need to understand how the culture blames and punishes Black mothers for the violence and oppression that they experience in this country routinely. You know, Marissa is someone who has experienced and was targeted by domestic violence. And instead of the state taking that very seriously, and supporting her as someone who's been victimized. Instead, she was blamed and criminalized for being so bold as to survive that violence. So I think that the practice of punishing and blaming mothers, blaming women who are experiencing violence, is one of the things that's really driving this mass incarceration crisis in this country. And so I think that everyone needs to understand the structural and systemic problems, but I also think we should reflect on how that works out culturally, the ways that individuals and communities also blame and punish mothers in our own ways for experiencing violence and oppression, for the conditions of violence and oppression that women are surviving all the time. Black mothers need our support and our respect. So this is a great Mother's Day to exercise that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also in this article that was written by Monica Ray Simpson, Executive Director of Sister Song, she writes in this article that Stand Your Ground for Marissa is July 25th through 28th in Jacksonville, Florida, which is coming up in 2 months. And that's July 25th to 28th because Marissa is supposed to go back to court on the 28th. And this is going to be, there's going to be a standing our ground, raising our voices against reproductive oppression and violence against women. And that weekend is going to begin with a community-wide Reproductive Justice 101 training, followed by a full-day institute where Sister Song's national member organizations as well as activists across social change movements, which I presume includes the two of yours, are going to be hosting workshops so that people can know about this. And the weekend's going to culminate with a march on July 28th, the day of Alexander's retrial, to the Duval County Unified Courthouse to stand in solidarity with Alexander and in opposition to the reproductive injustices that this case and legislation has made public. And she writes, Alexander's case reminds of the very reason the reproductive justice framework was needed. It also gives reproductive justice activists an opportunity to lean into the intersectionality of our framework and to take another bold step forward in eradicating reproductive oppression. So, it's really, really good article. It's in the current issue of the San Francisco Bay View. So I want to thank both of you so much for joining us, and perhaps we can have you on again with someone from Florida to talk about how things went on the ground, and people can continue to stay in touch, as you mentioned. Give us the website again, please.
That's www.freemarissanow.org.
Mm-hmm. And what will you be doing this weekend, the two of you?
Let's see. We've been in the Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Marissa. We've been gathering Mother's Day cards and taking them to our organizations and getting a lot of cards signed and participating in this week that way, really trying to spread the word.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Elisa, what are you doing in the Bay Area?
I'm personally going to be continuing to focus on different kinds of writings and writing projects and organizing projects that are addressing gender violence here in the community and in the U.S., the United States, and internationally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and of course, I will be seeing my mother and thinking of other mothers and people like Marissa who are behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is there's something happening tomorrow, and I got a postcard when I went to the Lynn Stewart Welcome Home last week, but I can't find it right now. There's a woman who's an environmental activist, also a mother, who was given, I believe, like 20 or something years. And there's a – do you know who I'm talking about, Elisa? Because it's happening here in the San Francisco Bay Area tomorrow, and I don't have her name right in front of me.
Are you talking about, wait, she's a mother? No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah, she's an environmental activist, and I think she got like 20 years or something.
I'm not surprised, although I am, that's a terrible, awful situation. I'm not familiar. I am familiar with the case in New York with the Occupy Wall Street activist who was attacked by a police officer and was found guilty and now is facing some prison time as a result of reacting to being attacked. So, but I'm not familiar with this with the local case of the environmental activist who's being targeted.
Okay, I have to find that. Okay, well, I will. I'll email you all once I find
great.
Her name, because I find a little postcard. Maybe you might be able to tap into that, at least since you're here.
That'd be great.
Alrighty. Well, are you the one of your mothers?
No.
No, ma'am.
Okay. Well.
I do have a mother
okay,
who I love.
Great.
So I will
right.
be wishing her a happy Mother's Day.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and looking forward to other conversations in the near future. And hopefully we'll be celebrating Marissa's release. That'd be really wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
Oh, you're welcome. Take good care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Irina. How are you?
Good. How are you? Good morning.
I'm fine. How was your tango class last night?
Oh, it was fun. It was great.
So, Irina, how do you pronounce your last name? Rifkin? Is that how you say it?
Rifkin. Irina Rifkin.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah, we're so happy to have you join us to talk about this wonderful fundraising, this musical event that you're participating in as a fundraiser for a Sierra Harmony and Healing Retreat at the Clear Air Mountain House, an eco-friendly retreat space in Sierra Buttes near Yuba River and over 40 lakes, for Laney College CalWORKS EOPS Care B2B, Helping Families Rise Above Poverty Through Community College Education Programs, which is really, really wonderful. Why don't you tell us about the event, which is May 11th, the Peace, Music, and Massage Benefit at Rose Street House of Music.
So that's actually a collaboration between myself and Toby Lessem, and Toby's here right now as well.
Hi, Toby. I didn't know you all were on the same phone. How are you?
Good, and you?
I'm fine. Well, great you can join us. Toby, you're with Whole Self Health, and you're going to be providing chair massages at the benefit this Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us about the event. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it started as a collaboration, and Toby does amazing massage therapy and also volunteers at providing massage therapy to domestic violence survivors. And I work at Laney College as a counselor for students who are part of CalWORKS EOPS Care and B2B. And I had done other fundraisers before for our students, and we decided to collaborate on this one and to really focus the message on peace and music and massage and raise funds for both organizations. And then I had I also felt that the theme of peace, music, and massage is really relevant for something that both organizations are really experiencing. And actually, a lot of the students that are part of the program have experienced challenges, and including many have experienced domestic violence. And so I feel it's something that's really important to, bring awareness to the issue and also sing empowering songs to rise up above violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Irina is really, it's really interesting. Shows how, one can't necessarily, not pigeonhole is not quite the word for it, but, you're a counselor, at the community college, and yet you're also a performance artist. Your performance includes live on the spot vocal arrangements, swirling vocal percussive beats, and textured interweaving harmony that you create on stage using a loop station instrument. And Michael Dugan in the San Francisco Chronicle wrote that you, quote, perform your own breathtaking act as a live one-woman choir using digital looping technology to an astonishing effect. And so I was wondering sort of how you marry your performance work with your, and I presume it's almost like another kind of performance work, you know, as a counselor or a therapist for students who come into your office, you know, in the CalWORKS ELPS Care B2B program. And I'm sure our audience doesn't know what any of this means. So maybe you could tell us who are the students that you see. You mentioned that domestic violence is an issue with many of your students, and probably students that you don't see, because I believe the CalWORKS ELPS program is an income-based program, which means that if you have too much money, maybe you don't see those particular students, because students that economically fit the profile maybe are not representative of the entire college population that might be affected by violence within the home.
That's true, because violence happens at all income levels. And the students I work with are CalWORKS, who are the students who are participating in the Welfare to Work program, and who, and then I work with EOPS students who are low-income students who are often the first in their family to go to college. And CARE is for single parents. And then B2B is a program that works with former foster youth. I find that I'm really inspired by working with the students and, working in collaboration with other faculty and staff and also with community agencies. And I just really feel inspired as well when students rise up and graduate and reach their goals. And so that's something that's really important to my purpose in life, like why I feel I'm here. And then it also is inspiring for some of the songs that I write. In fact, the most recent song that I wrote, I actually wrote the chorus originally when I was thinking about students that I was really concerned about that are experiencing domestic violence. And then I wrote the rest of the song thinking about all my students who are graduating this year. About 59 of my students are graduating, completing certificates or degrees or transferring. And so that's kind of how that song came about. And then the Rise Up song, that's the song that I do a lot of live looping on. It's the closest I get to rap music. And that one I came up with after, at the end of 2009, when there were very, very severe budget cuts, when the former governor had proposed completely eliminating all CalWORKS programs across the state and actually cut CalWORKS programs in half and even more. Very, very severely. So that song came out of that.
Wow. before we have you share Our Future is Stronger Than Fear, is that the first one you mentioned?
Yes.
Okay. Toby, you could tell our audience how you and Irina met, and tell us a bit about Whole Self Health, your massage practice.
Okay. Irina and I were fortunate to meet to live together, and we soon found out that we had similar interests in terms of, you know, using the work that we did to really help other people, and specifically within the, you know, lower income and domestic violence realms. And, my business has really been just rooted in, as you know, in events and fundraising opportunities, you know, to really connect with specifically the Center for Domestic Peace. We you know, right now what we do is we go there, we once a month, we give massages, and I have an amazing partner who does personal coaching. And so we partner up, and she does a coaching session with the women, and then we do massage. And so that way they really address, you know, some of the root issues that they're dealing with. And then in their bodies, they can really learn how to let them go or address them as needed. And it's just, it's really amazing to be able to, you know, see the women just transform after they've been through a few of these sessions, and they open up to themselves in ways that, you know, they haven't been able to, and for some of them ever, but a lot of them in many years. And it's just great to be just right on site with them, you know, literally hands-on, and very, very, it's a very personal experience, and they just, like I said, just open up and really, we see amazing results. So we're continuing the efforts by, with the Peace Music and Massage, by really, you know, getting some funds raised so that, you know, it's more than the once a month. We need to be able to give them back so that they can help, you know, we provide for their children. There's some services, and then also to get more therapy coaching in there on a more regular basis.
Mm-hmm. So where does this happen once a month? And you mentioned the Center for Domestic Peace. Where is that place? So I was reading about your practice, that that has evolved health practices and community involvement, whole self health. That's the basis philosophically of your practice, and it includes myofascial release. I don't know what that is. Trigger point therapy, deep tissue, Swedish sports massage, and prenatal massage, and you know, within the whole hands on, you know, laying on the hands, we think about energy, moving the energy, you know, sort of releasing and unblocking energy as well. And I was also wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. But where is the Center for Domestic Peace?
Yeah, so the Center for Domestic Peace is in Marin County. And they used to go by another name, the Marin Abused Women Center, but they changed it to a little bit more of a positive spin in the name. I like what you said about the energy. That's a huge element of it. Just to touch on one of the things you said, the myofascial release is a type of massage therapy that works with the layers, myofascial meaning muscle and connective tissue. So it sort of is the idea of, you know, going through. You can't rush through to the very bottom. You have to really work through the various layers of the muscle, and also energetically working through the various layers to really address, you know, what's going on and what the needs are. The energy part is definitely integral to all of the body work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So Irina, when you think about sort of healing from you know, violent situations, whether that's a physical violence or economic violence or social or racial violence, you know, because we have, you know, we live in a world here in the United States that, you know, there's structural violence, you know, as, you know, for women of color, you know, for people that are poor, people who show up in different body type forms, you know, big women versus small women. And then we think about, you know, the mothers, you know, we're talking, this is Mother's Day weekend. Just wondering how your students are able to participate in this whole self-help kind of philosophy. I mean, have they been able to actually get massage and this retreat that you're raising funds for? How big is the buy-in to going away and from the city and staying in the wilderness, and how you know, sort of are students looking forward to being a part of this retreat that you have planned?
So let's see. First of all, starting in terms of the healing,
the students are not necessarily participating in the whole self-help in terms of Toby's services, but mm-hmm. there are actually services at the college through the health center where there's massage and acupuncture and other health services
nice.
That really address the whole body and the mind as well. And so I often refer my students to those services. In terms of the retreat, it's kind of far away, so it might, that's not something I haven't, you know, that idea just came about. The retreat is probably primarily more of a fundraiser. I'm going to be teaching live looping workshops and
mm-hmm.
Harmony workshops, and I'm actually looking for a collaborator to co-produce the retreat. And then there'll be concerts and music jams and all of that. And so that particular retreat isn't something I've really brought up at the college or, you know, it's really a new idea. But it was an idea that I had to try to raise funds for the program. Last year, a year ago, I did a retreat as well, but it was really even more far away. It was in Hawaii to raise funds for the program. I thought I'd come a little bit closer this time, but it's not super close. I think it would be good one day to do a retreat that's maybe, this retreat is about 3.5 hours away from the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
although it would be good, I think, at one point to do something a little bit closer, mm-hmm. which would actually be more likely to actually bring in students.
Well,
but,
3 hours is not that far. I mean, not that, I mean, closer is not necessarily better. I know where, you know, this location, and it's really beautiful there, and it's good to get away, and 3 hours is not that far. I mean, it's not like 6 hours or 12 hours. I mean, it's 3 hours.
You don't have to
and once you get
there,
you stay for a while. Yeah, uh-huh.
Yes, you don't have to take a plane to get there, and it is really beautiful. It's just,
mm-hmm.
and actually that's an inspiration for music as well, to be in nature and to really just kind of settle in to nature. I find that I don't write very many songs during the actual year because I'm really focused on my work. And so this summer I'm also hoping to write more songs as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think as a part of, you know, the work that you do, it'd be great, you know, perhaps, you know, you could talk to the folks, you know, the administrators about, you know, sort of incorporating a retreat into the whole EOPS experience. That'd be really nice because, you know, people don't get a chance to go away. I mean, people barely get out of Oakland, let alone get out of, you know, the city, you know, going to other places. I mean, who knows about the Buttes, you know, Sierra Buttes? Not many people. How many people know any lakes other than Lake Merritt? which is not, yeah. So why don't you share one of your songs with us, maybe the first one we spoke of, and then we can close with the Rise Up.
Hey, so Irina's just grabbing a speaker so she's able to perform, but they're...
Here it is. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sure can. Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm going to see if I can... I'm on a different phone now.
Yes, nice clear phone, too. I can hear you very well.
Okay, good. I'm going to use the mic because my voice is a little quiet. And I apologize for my morning voice, but this song is a song I just finished last week, and it's called Our Future is Stronger Than Fear. And I imagine kind of singing this song with everybody singing along on the chorus and on the call and response part as well. May you be safe, may you be free, may you always clearly see your power that flows deep inside, in a thousand rivers wide. May you be safe, may you be free, may you always clearly see, there is a reason you are here. Your future is stronger than fear. When bullets fly, when engines roar, your future is stronger than fear. you still know why your spirit soared. Your future is stronger than fear. You dream your dreams, you look ahead. Your future is stronger than fear. Life slams you down, but you rise instead. Your future is stronger than fear. We will be safe, we will be free. We will always clearly see a power that flows deep inside is a thousand rivers wide. We will be safe, we will be free. We will always clearly see there is a reason we are here. Our future is stronger than fear. A river runs to reach the sea. Our future is stronger than fear. Our purpose here, it sets us free. Our future is stronger than fear. No dam can block our current's flow. Our future is stronger than fear. Nothing can stop us when we know our future is stronger than fear. I will be safe, I will be free. I will always clearly see my power that flows deep inside is a thousand rivers wide. I will be safe, I will be free. I will always clearly see there is a reason I am here. My future is stronger than fear. This is the reason we are here. Our future is stronger than fear.
Oh, that's really beautiful. Very lovely.
Thank you so much. I'm actually going to be, the first time I'm going to be performing the song is at the benefit, and everybody's singing along, and I'm actually going to also sing it at the awards ceremony honoring our EOPS CalWORKS Care and B2B graduates, and I'm hoping that that they'll sing along. And in fact, the last chorus, I used I because I imagine everybody singing along and kind of talking about their own experience while they're singing.
Right, yeah. When is the graduation from Atlantic College for EOPS?
Well, the awards ceremony honoring our graduates is on May 22nd. And the theme is I Am Powerful. So that's why I really like for the students to sing My Power That Flows. Because I feel that they're really powerful with the fact that they have overcome so much and are graduating and are really reaching upwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And in your Rise Up, you actually say we are powerful, and that's one of the that's in the lyrical content of the work.
Oh yes, I actually every year I actually adapt that verse for.
Oh. Oh, that's great. That's great. So tell our audience again about the fundraiser Sunday, where it is, and I was wondering with regards to the Center for Domestic Peace, who do you see there? Like, what women is sort of like the demographic of the women that come there? Because Marin County is not an extremely diverse community. And I was wondering, do people come from out of Marin County to the center? You know, sort of who is seen there?
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I find such a draw to work at this location. It's because, like you said, Marin itself doesn't tend to be very diverse, and yet the women of the Center for Domestic Peace are extremely diverse from all economic backgrounds, different, you know, races, different age groups. And a lot of them do come from other areas, unfortunately, because they are they've been displaced in a lot of areas that the people that they were dealing with in the abuse cases have found them. And so it's for some of them it's been a last resort. It's really actually beautiful to see that within this county of, you know, Marin has quite the abundance in a lot of ways. It's really nice to see that there's these efforts sort of within that context of really treating the people that, you know, oftentimes get overlooked with just such, you know, such amazing services and, you know, really an amazing group of people working together, you know, for the children and for the women. So yes, within the center, it's very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
In many times, actually, as a domestic violence counselor, I found that many shelters don't accept those who are living in the area because they're concerned that the abuser could follow them to the shelter. So many times in many shelters, it's common for the survivors to be from all different areas.
Mhm. One of the women who is on staff at the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, Samantha, in an article that was in the East Bay Express, Samantha Rogers spoke about how, as a victim of domestic violence or spousal abuse, she, because she had, I think, a drug charge or something like that, she was ineligible for certain types of government resources around housing and support to get away from the abuser. So she didn't have any. She had no money or resources to be able to live away from this person, and so that just compounded the risk that her life was at. You know, once she was released. I believe you spoke a little bit about that when we were off the air yesterday, Irene, about sort of different types of resources that are not available when one might have a record.
Yes, and that's a really can be challenging, especially since sometimes those who are abused sometimes develop a record as a result of the abuse that happens to them. And so it's including drug charges that may happen when they feel that they have no choice but to participate in something that they otherwise wouldn't have chosen. There is an organization that's part of the East Bay Community Law Center called the Clean Slate. So they refer students to that resource as well. But it is more challenging because, unfortunately, a lot of systems are, you know, there are more barriers, which is actually, to me, that's really sad that those barriers exist because I think that it's really important for the services to be available to everybody who needs them.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. The Rose Street House of Music is a fragrance-free house concert and musical community, bringing out women's voices through poetic music of substance and depth, and all genders are welcome. So, and then you're going to be joined by Solstice, a female vocal ensemble which regularly composes, commissions, and arranges new songs. So give us the address again and the time for the program on Sunday.
It's 1839 Rose Street in Berkeley, and it's a house, so it doesn't have a sign or anything like that. And the website to get all of the details is www.rosestreetmusic.org. It's not .com, it's .com, .org, but it's www.rosestreetmusic.org.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and what time?
7:30 p.m.
11, you said 11:30?
No, I'm sorry, 7:30 in the evening.
Oh, 7:30 p.m. Oh, okay. All right. And so 7:30 to around what time?
Until about 10 o'clock, probably.
Okay, great. And what's the donation?
So it's suggested 15 to infinity. And for those who are low income or work part-time, the suggested donation is $10. And 100% of the money is going to the organizations And also 100% of the massage donations are also going to the organization.
The Center for Domestic Peace?
Center for Domestic Peace and also Laney College, CalWORKs EOPS Care B2B.
Okay, cool, super. What I want to ask you. So before you sing your other song you prepare for us, because our other guest is in the studio, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about Solstice Sings.
Solstice is an a cappella ensemble, and I actually first heard them, I think they performed here at Rose Street about 10 years ago, and I just love their harmonies and felt like they were a really good fit for this particular event, especially because it can be really wonderful to hear harmonies while you're relaxing and getting a massage, to hear voices interweaving together. So harmony is kind of something that's kind of central to the music that's going to be a part of this concert. And so I'm really excited to hear them again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And Rose Street, what's the cross street, Rose and what?
It's near Martin Luther King. It's right next door
okay.
to Chapel.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's right. It's very near King Middle School, too.
Oh, yes. In fact, it's right between King Middle School and Bad Apples Restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a block
okay.
away.
Oh, nice. Oh, sounds really lovely. So is there like a garden or something?
The house, we have a small garden. We don't have a huge garden. It's not... not very big garden. Just a little garden.
Is this your house?
Yes, that's where I live.
Wow. So you've opened your home to the community? Oh, my goodness. You and and Toby? Wow. You are such entrepreneurs, my goodness. Such entrepreneurs at that, I would say.
We don't actually make any money from the house concerts because we either they're benefits where all the money is going to a cause, or if there's performers who are doing regular shows here, then it goes to support the performers. So we had another concert in April, and 100% of the money went to the artists so that they can keep doing their work. We don't make any money on it, but it's really we do it for the music, for the cause, and
wow, how lovely.
Going on
okay.
15 years.
15 years, wow, that is awesome. That's awesome. That's really great.
Four concerts a month, but now we have four a year.
Oh, okay, four concerts a year, okay. So these are real special.
Yeah, they are.
Well, why don't you tell us about the other song you prepare for us.
So this is called Rise Up, and I wrote it at the end of 2009 when the Terminator, the former governor, had proposed completely eliminating CalWORKs programs across the state and actually unfortunately succeeded in cutting the programs in half. And I saw how this affected my students and the students are actually in a hard economy, especially the students are needing the services more than ever. And so this song came out of it. And then the last verse that I added came out of seeing my students graduate despite the struggles. And so it's called Rise Up. And what I'm doing actually while I'm singing this song, and I'm going to be doing this right now, is everything is completely live, created on the spot. So you're going to hear about 9 different parts, but I'm actually going to sing them live right now, and I use a loop station to loop everything I'm singing as it's happening. So it's really in the moment. can arise up. Lead the steps for new careers. People can arise up. For an education, people can arise up. For student services to help you through, people can arise up. Cause your future's up to you. You want to rise up, but jobs don't pay enough without misguided education. So life is feeling rough. The economy's down. It's time to go to school, to community, college, and your future's up to you.
Until you hear it.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's simply lovely. So do you have any CDs out, Irina, that people can purchase off your website? I know you have all the music that people can listen to and watch you in performance, which is really great. So why don't you give your website, but can people buy any of this?
Yes, actually, there's a link on there, I believe, to CD Baby where they can buy the CDs. And it's www.irinarifkin, IrinaRivkin.com. But people can also buy CDs at the benefit concert, Peace, Music, and Massage. And any CDs sold at the benefit concert, 100% of that is going to the Laney College EOPS CalWORKs Care programs. And I'm really looking forward to sharing the music in person.
Right, and that's going to be on Mother's Day, 7:30 to about 10, at 1839 Rose Street, which is the Rose House. Is that? Am I remembering correctly? I'm not reading right now.
Oh, no problem. The Rose Street House of Music.
Rose Street
which
House.
Which is a house concert. We are asking everybody, because I'm actually allergic to perfume and cologne, and then some of the folks who come to the concerts who are often not able to go to concerts in most venues because of chemical sensitivities are also allergic to perfume and cologne. So we're asking everybody to not wear fragrances to the house concerts here.
Okay, super. All righty. Well, gosh, it's really great speaking to Irina and Toby, and have a great time on Sunday, and I'm going to have to make it to one of these concerts, and wow, it just sounds really fabulous, and maybe I might be able to come to the graduation at Laney on the 22nd to see all these students whom you work with and hear you do this song live.
Well, thank you so much, Wanda, for having your wonderful show and also for having us as guests on your show.
Thank you again. Oh, you're welcome, Toby. You take good care. Have a good rest of the day.
Take care, Wanda. Thank you.
You're welcome. Goodbye. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
You too. Goodbye.
Bye. Good morning, Riot. How are you?
Hey, Wanda. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I saw your phone call. I was like, oh, okay. Because I'm like, are they going to be joining me or not? So I believe, according to Mace, you sent me that Zakiya is not going to be joining you. You're going to be holding it down.
Well,
she's
here. Hello. Say hello.
Oh.
Zakiya.
Yeah. Hi, Wanda. Good morning.
Oh,
how
hey,
are you?
Zakiya. Good morning. Good morning. I know you are busy planning this wonderful Mother's Day event for Sunday, 3 to 6 at Joyce Gordon Gallery in Oakland?
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's correct. Yeah, we're excited about the performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So tell us about this this wonderful concert tribute, and who are the mothers you're honoring?
Okay, so this concert is a special Mother's Day concert that we are honoring six mothers in the Bay Area. The mothers are Eunice Booker of Richmond, Juanita Duval of Oakland, Joyce Gordon of Oakland, Lona Hanif of Oakland, Evelyn Murray of Richmond, who now resides in outside of Richmond, in San Jose, and, of course, you, Wanda Sabria. So those are our six honorees, and so this is a celebration of the mothers, and we are, Bryant's band is backing us, Bryant is singing, so it's jazz and poetry, my original poetry, and I have written special poems for mothers for that day. So there will be, of course, other poems, but there are several that are dedicated to mothers.
Mm-hmm.
So we are excited about this celebration, this event, and we are hoping that the community comes out and supports this event. Also, there's something very special happening that day as well, Joyce has an exhibit on view of Emory Douglas's work, and so that's very exciting. So that's a special bonus that people get to come out to the show. They get to see the artwork as well.
And for people who are not familiar or who are not aware of the name Emory Douglas, Emory Douglas is the artist the longtime artist that was affiliated with the Black Panthers, who produced all that wonderful artwork for the Black Panthers. He's going to have an exhibit at Joyce Gordon's gallery that day. So we're very excited about the affair. There will be food served at the reception, and it's going to be just a lovely evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Emory's Minister of Culture, former member, Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party, and in the artwork, he, you know, sort of illustrates the role of women in the organization and the role of women in the community. You see a lot of women, you know, in his work, so it seems like a real fitting kind of framework for this celebration of these women, quite a few of whom are actually activists and, you know, community activists and really involved you know, in society in a real tangible way. How did you come to choose these six women, and why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, all six women are women that we are friends of, people that we've met since we moved here to the West Coast. Originally, Sakia and I are from New York, and we came out here around 12 years ago. We didn't know anyone here in the West Coast, and we decided to move out of New York and drove a big van cross-country, and it's been a wonderful experience thus far. And in that interim, we met many positive people like yourself and other women and brothers who are part of our network. So the women that we mentioned, Lola Hanif, her husband, M.B. Hanif, will be actually sitting in. He will be one of the guest artists on the show that day. He will be playing on a couple of the tunes that we'll be performing. And he's been a good friend of mine, a musical collaborator with me for many years. Also, Juanita Duvall is the mother of Dorothea Duvall. A lot of people might know her. She's an activist in the community and a mental health specialist person in the community. Evelyn Murray. Evelyn Murray is the mother of Cora Murray. And Cora is a dear friend of ours. We were neighbors for many years. And her parents, Cora's parents, adopted my wife and I as their adopted children. So it's just a lot of love that we have for these women, and we wanted to take the opportunity to give them their flowers while we can.
I wanted to add that Mother Murray, Evelyn Murray is the eldest. She's turned 95 last year, so she is very cognitive and spry and very sophisticated, and she is just a treasure.
Unfortunately, Mother Murray lost her husband, who she was married to for over 70 years. She just lost him recently over last month or so. So, but she's doing well, and we are excited that she will be coming to the performance.
Also wanted to would like to let the audience know that Joyce Gordon Gallery is located at 406 14th Street between Broadway and Franklin in Oakland, and it's accessible by the BART if you're not driving. And also, we wanted to give people the information of the other musicians that will be performing that day. And on piano will be Vincent Koo. Alex Smith will be the upright bassist. Michael Spencer is on drums.
And I guess it's also important to mention to our listening audience that we're going to have a wonderful cuisine to serve for a reception after the performance. It's going to be part vegan for our vegetarian lovers. We got a vegan restaurant that's going to cater part of the food. And also we're going to have also some nice fish and chicken for ones who like to eat meat as well. But we're so excited. And again, we're just looking for folks to come out and to hopefully support this event and enjoy the program that we have in store for them.
So Wanda, yes. We have prepared three pieces. And if we may start, it would be great.
Before that, I wanted to ask you I think it's Mrs. Murray at 95. Is she the eldest? And it seems like you have kind of a range of mothers you're honoring with regards to ages and generations.
Well, we actually didn't do it in that way, but we know that she is the eldest, and so that's why I wanted to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe probably Juanita Duvall would be the next after Mother Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And Eunice Booker would probably be the third in line, but Lola Hanif and yourself and Joyce would be the three that would be younger.
Yeah, it's nice. And the whole idea of, you know, sort of honoring, you know, the black mother. Black mothers aren't honored that much.
True, that's true. So, yeah, the flowers, while we can smell them, are so important. And black mothers do so much for the community. And also, you know, we're honoring women in general because we believe, Bryant and I, that all women are mothers, whether you have given birth or not, because we nurture our families. We nurture other people, too, that are not in our families. And so it's so important to acknowledge that, you know, mothers do so much.
Juana, I think it's important to also mention that this program is in dedication to my mother, Minnie Ruth McDonald, who actually passed away in 2011. We got a call 6 months before she passed away from her doctor saying that she was terminally ill, and I flew out to the East Coast and moved her, all her belongings out to the West Coast, and she came to live with Sakia and I for several months until she passed away. And that was such a humbling experience for me to be connected to my mother at the time of her death and to be there for her as she was for being there for me all of my life. So it's an opportunity for me to honor her and to honor her memory and also to honor the kid's mother who is still living, who is presently living there in New York and on the East Coast. So we are honoring our mothers by doing this show, and all mothers, regardless of what race they are, it doesn't matter. They can be from the African-American community, which we are from, but also we are honoring mothers from all communities because mothers are the ones who create life and make this world go round with life. So that's why we're doing this program.
Yeah, wonderful. And I remember your wonderful program you had in February where you featured your lovely wife, Zakia, you know, performing these wonderful poems that you arranged music around. I mean, the synergy between, you know, your quintet and Zakia was just awesome. And so that experience was just really, really, really sort of top-notch performance. And so people will really, really enjoy, you know, the music and the poetry because you are really integrated, Zakia, into the actual work. You're not just featured, you know, like, oh, we're going to have poetry and then here's the music over here. It's all, you know, a part of the whole production, which is really wonderful. And your writing is extraordinary. Hopefully, you might have books available. Are they out yet?
Oh, actually not. I'm still working on the book, but we will have a double CD from the 57th Street Gallery on sale for Sunday.
Nice.
As promised, we did. The audience was so enthralled at the gallery, at 57th Street Gallery in February. They wanted to buy my CD or book or something. So we were able to get the CD together. And the book is still being worked on, but that's upcoming, hopefully, you know, as soon as I can finish it. So, yes. So
congratulations.
That
how wonderful. Well,
thank you.
Yes, we're excited about this double set CD. It's the full concert that we did at 57th Street Gallery, both two sets that we did. And we have all the guest artists that we presented that evening on the CD. Brother Hanif is playing, and also Larry Douglas was a fabulous trumpet player, is a fabulous trumpet player, and Malakat player, who's on the CD. So we're excited that we were able to have the CD available this Sunday coming. Mm-hmm. Also, I have my CD that I have with my quintet with me just doing straight-ahead jazz That would also will be available on Sunday as well. And also we on that CD at 57th Street Gallery, we had Mr. Butch Warren, Mr. Butch Haynes, who's a fabulous kunga player here in the Bay Area. He was one of our guest artists as well.
Nice, nice. Okay, cool. So there is an admission cost, so I want you to let our audience know about that so they won't be surprised. And there's a way to get tickets online to save yourself, I believe, $5 or something like that?
The tickets online are at brownpapertickets.com, and they can find it by looking for Mother's Day Celebration at Joyce Gordon Gallery. So that's a better way to get the tickets because they are less expensive. At the door, it costs a little more. Shall I get the price, Wanda? Okay, so the price online is $20, and at the door is $25. I want to add that for children under 12, it's free admission, and 12 to 18 is half price. So please, this is a family affair. We're hoping that the family comes out with their mothers, their aunties, their grandmothers, and celebrate. This is a mini family reunion of our community. So please, that is it's going to be spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Okay, super. Well, you said you have a couple of poems, and my next guest is not in the studio just yet, so
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, so we're going to start out with Brian playing piano and singing. You are the sunshine of my life, and my poem, first poem, will be for mothers. Thank you. if my movements caused you any pain, for that was not my aim. I only wanted to let you know, Mother dear, I love you so.
You are the sunshine of my life, Mother. That's why I always be around. I, you are the apple of my eye. Forever you stay in love. I know that this is the beginning. 'Cause you came to my rescue. If I thought this was the ending, found myself drowning in my own tears. You are the sunshine of my life, and that's why I always be around. Ooh, you are the apple of my
Oh, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I think I have time for you to do one more because my guest is not in the studio yet.
Okay, this is an original composition by Brian. Wanda?
Yes.
Actually, this is Little Sunshower.
Oh, I'm sorry. Release the body entrapped in the vicious cycle of confusion. Once you decide enough is enough, look into the mirrors of self. I am rejoicing because it is your time again to lead the world.
Well, thank you so much. That was beautiful. My other guest is in the studio now. So why don't you give us the details again, Zakiya or Bryant, about the Mother's Day celebration at Joyce Gordon Gallery this Sunday, Mother's Day, May 11th. From 6 to...
Mother's Day. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You said, I think it's 6 to 9, right? No, not 6 to 9. No, it's 3 to 6.
3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on this Sunday, May the 11th, Mother's Day, at Joyce Gordon Gallery, which is located at 406 14th Street in Oakland between Broadway and Franklin.
Again, because I think I talked over that accidentally.
Yeah, the time again is from 3 o'clock in the afternoon to 6. And again, Emery Douglas is the artist that's going to be on exhibit that day, and food will be served at the reception. And again, I invite all folks to come out if you're interested, you want to have something to do for Mother's Day. This is a great opportunity to salute your moms and to enjoy good music and poetry at the same time.
Right, yeah, definitely. And, you know, those two selections for people who don't know your work, they are just an indicator of, I mean, just imagine, you know, the full band. this would be really phenomenal. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks so much for honoring me as well as one of these mothers that are being your hosting the tribute to.
Oh, you're so welcome. You're so deserving. We're glad that we are able to do this, Wanda. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, you have a good rest of the day, and I am going to be traveling that day, so I won't be able to join you, but I will certainly be there in spirit.
Yes, we will fill you, and thank you for letting us know that you won't be able to be there, but we are still glad to honor you, and you have a safe trip, and we look forward to seeing you when you return.
All right, thank you so much. You take good care.
You're welcome,
thank
Wanda.
You.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye now.
Take care.
Bye. Peace and blessings. You too. Happy Mother's Day, Zakiya.
Yes. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye. See, I want to make an announcement really quickly before I welcome into the studio our next guest. And thank you so much for hanging in there, Tandisizwe. Shimon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you pronounce your last name, Tandi?
Shimaringa.
Shimaringa, yeah. Yeah, I know a dancer by that name, Nora Shimaringa, and you're the first person outside of her that I've actually seen that name. Do you know Nora?
She's
with the Urban Bush Women. She's also Zimbabwean as well. Okay, cool. Well, before we start, you could talk about, this wonderful book, No Doubt, The Murder or Murders of Oscar Grant, that is just being released. And you're going to be here in Northern California for two events, Wednesday, May 14th from 7 to 9 at the Pena Cultural Center. And then you're also going to be staying through the weekend, Malcolm X weekend, Sunday, May 18th at 5 o'clock at the Green Arcade Bookstore in San Francisco. I got this flyer at the Welcome Home, Lynn Stewart, who's the people's attorney, and this is an evening of solidarity for Marie Mason and women in prison, and it's tomorrow, May 10th, at 7 p.m. Station 40, 3030B 16th Street in San Francisco, and the event is not wheelchair accessible, unfortunately. And Marie Mason, is a longtime environmental and labor movement activist and the loving mother of two. And on February 5, 2009, she was sentenced to almost 22 years in prison for actions in which no one was injured. Marie was transferred in 2010 to the High Security Tight Restricted Unit of the notorious FMC Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas. She received no explanation for the transfer. So this particular event or gathering is to learn more about the campaign to move Maria and get an update on how she's doing and firsthand report of what it's like to visit a loved one at FMC Carswell and about other women serving time with Maria. And there's a website, supportmariamason.org, and you can also go to womenprisoners.org, which is where California Coalition for Women Prisoners posts the Fire Inside newsletter. So tell us about your book. You attended the hearings and the trial for Meserly, and this book sort of comes from that place of covering that trial. And we talk about different trials of the century, and certainly this one here is historic, and it's really great that, you know, you recount the trial and the case in this book. So tell us about, you know, that experience.
Well, it wasn't a very pleasant experience. It was historic, as you mentioned. Meserly was the first police officer in the state of California to be charged with murder while on duty, and that's because of the work of people in the Bay Area in particular. So we're thankful for that. Unfortunately, he was not convicted of murder. He was convicted of involuntary manslaughter and did 1 year behind bars in the Los Angeles County Jail. But, again, it was still historic. Actually, sitting in the trial, it was kind of painful when you get right down to it for a lot of different reasons. I was there as an observer, as a reporter, but there were things that I saw that made me angry. But if I had spoken on them, I would have been thrown out of the courtroom and wouldn't have been able to be the observer and be the witness. So that was on the one end. On the other hand, you know, I talk about in the book how Oscar Grant was murdered by Johannes Meserly and Anthony Peroni for the first time on January 1st. He would be murdered by the courts and the media thereafter. So the lies that were told in court and in legal documents to paint a picture of Oscar Grant as a thug, as someone who was deserving of what happened to him, that was also painful. White supremacy has a habit of never, ever assuming responsibility for its actions, but it always talks about responsibility when it comes to people of color. And so to watch that process unfold, it was educational, but at the same time, it was also painful.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Was it unexpected? I mean, I think about sort of your background, you know, as a award-winning grassroots community journalist, you know, based in Los Angeles. And you've been doing this work, you know, for over 20 years.
Well, I hadn't been covering trials, though.
Ah.
I hadn't been covering trials, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, no, it was not unexpected, but, you know, when you get up and when you see it unfolding before your eyes, it's like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So how did that impact what you do, you know, as media?
Well, it's made me more determined to document, to not only just be a passive recorder, but also to give my own analysis of what it is that I think is I'm witnessing, what it is I'm recording, because it's important that we tell our own stories. It's important that we have our own analysis out there, just like everyone else has an analysis out there. So I'm even more committed to doing that now than ever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I just think about, you know, after, you know, the verdict in the Oscar Grant trial, you know, Trayvon Martin is killed. And then you look at that trial. I'm sure in other trials that are not as high profile, you know, sort of within you know, this state and elsewhere, I'm sure the lens through which you view these things has altered.
Well, yeah, like I said, if you're not familiar with it, like I said, that was the first time that I had ever covered a criminal trial like that. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it definitely altered my lens. Now, the trial of Mesley was in 2010. Unfortunately, I didn't get the book out. I didn't start working on the book seriously until about 2012 when I found out that Fruitvale Station was going to be made. If I had gotten the book out in 2010 or 2011 or whenever, prior to last July when Fruitvale Station came out, then people would not have been surprised by what they saw with Zimmerman's trial, because I argue that there's a particular playbook that all white supremacist murders follow, specifically police murders. But again, white supremacist murders, similar to Michael Dunn and, of course, George Zimmerman's, Mesley's trial was not televised, but Zimmerman's trial was. And so, you know, that playbook talks about how there's a hesitancy to charge the perpetrator. The police almost don't want to do it. It takes a while, if not a rebellion, in order to get that process in motion. The playbook talks about how there's always this character assassination that takes place of the victim. Basically, the victim is put on trial, and it's made to look like the victim did something to deserve what they ended up getting. It talks about how there's institutional support somewhere in this process. Wherever we look, we're going to see some type of institutional support. As we found out as we went along, we saw that Zimmerman's father was a former judge, his mother was a court officer. So, you know, we can only imagine, because nobody wants to talk about exactly how that impacted on the decision to not charge George Zimmerman. We can only assume, unfortunately. The same thing with the Bart administration. Their procedures automatically assume that when an officer discharges their weapon, it's an accident, that they would never, ever discharge their weapon on purpose, intentionally. And that's what Mesley ended up saying on the night of the shooting. He had to pencil it in that it was a discharge of his weapon on the advice of his lawyer at that very moment. The form said it was accidental shooting, and his lawyer was like, no, this was not accidental, this was intentional. And that was that very night, January 1st, 2009. But we see the lie that was told in order to shield him from responsibility, that he meant to pull his taser instead of his weapon. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, so we look at how, you know, we have to criminalize the victim in order to justify law enforcement's response to two different incidents, and it's similar to what happens in warfare. You know, you sort of dehumanize the opponent, so then it's easier to kill them. And you know, a lot of the analogy of, you know, sort of what happens between police and various communities of color has been looked at as a war. So some of these tactics that come into play sort of mirror, you know, different kinds of war strategies. But then, you know, we sort of look at sort of the value of life, and we see that some life has a higher value than others. And mm-hmm. in your work, you know, around, you know, the founder of the Ida B. Wells Institute, which you write seeks to utilize old and new forms of media to advocate, educate, and mobilize. And the Institute was co-founder of the Women of Color Media Justice Initiative, a partnership with Mother's Day Radio and the Women's Leadership Project in Los Angeles. And then you mentioned to me, because I was asking you about the Voices from Behind the Walls. It's a cable access show in Atlanta, Georgia, and you mentioned that that's an initiative that looks at political prisoners and prisoners of war, and people don't even realize that we do have political prisoners and we have prisoners of war in the United States. And if you think about the Move 9, you know, who have served their sentences and keep are continually being denied parole, as well as other prisoners, you know, from various movements like the Black Panther Party movement and the Black Power movements that are still behind bars, you know, 30, 40 years, some of them in solitary confinement. We see that on the surface, this United States of America, you know, this democracy is not necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean the same thing for all people.
Right. Most deaf.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about sort of what came up for you, you know, as you were covering this trial. And then you mentioned that the book came out, you know, 2 years later. I mean, you started writing the book in 2012, I believe you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And in one of the points you mentioned that, you know, at the end of Fruitvale Station, you were struck by how Wanda Johnson, played by actress Olivia Spencer, was told she couldn't hold her son because his death had been declared a homicide. And it made you wonder about ownership in black bodies. And that's something that, you know, do we own our bodies? Like, if a mother can't hold her child and the mother, the child came through the mother, what does that mean?
Hmm. Well, yeah, you were telling me about I had actually forgotten that Mother's Day was coming up. You mentioned to me that this was going to be the Mother's Day, I guess, show, that's the first thing that came to my mind. I remember Wanda Johnson telling me about that, that she was the one who had suggested that they take Bart, and then that part about wanting to hold him and being told that she could not. So the whole thing of ownership and black bodies is a question that we don't like to deal with. You know, black people went from being the property of individual whites to the property of the state, and that's not by accident. You know, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery except as a punishment for a fit and necessary crime, according to the language of the Constitution. The other thing that we don't talk about is on the 14th Amendment, which allegedly gave folks the right to vote, except they could be denied the right to vote for certain crimes. And after the Civil War ended, after the period of chattel enslavement ended, white folks came up with a whole slew of crimes that were only crimes if black folks committed them. So there's this it still hangs over us, this ownership of black bodies, not the self-determination of African people of African descent, but the use of black bodies and the ownership of black bodies. And speaking of black bodies, it was, I talk about in the book how there's a, you know, I call it triple murder. There's the murder of Oscar Grant physically, then there was the murder in the media, which was based upon the lies told in the court. But there's actually another murder that occurs when stuff like this happens. It didn't just happen with Oscar Grant. It happened with, of course, Jordan Davis, with Trayvon Martin, and most of these white supremacist murders. And I call that the soul murder of the community, what happens as we witness what has happened to our loved one or this person that we are concerned about. We get murdered in the process, the callousness and the negligence, the rubbing in our faces. You know, when you announce on Trayvon Martin's, what would have been his 19th birthday, that his murderer, George Zimmerman, is going to be in a celebrity boxing match. You know, that's an issue of soul murder. And so one of the examples of soul murder I cite in the book is how Michael Raines, Johannes Mesley's defense attorney, was supposed to have entered into evidence this diagram of a body at autopsy. And he didn't do it in the beginning of the trial. He was referring to it, and the judge was like, well, what is this? Where did it come from? And he apologized to the judge. He hadn't brought it to the judge's attention earlier. So the judge asked him, well, what are you going to call this exhibit? What do you label it? And Raines very flippantly said, Exhibit KKK. And it was like only the black folks in the audience caught that. And it just seemed so highly offensive, you know. This black body, which is representing Oscar Grant, this diagram of a dead body at autopsy, which represents Oscar Grant, you're going to label it with the initials of an organization that is drenched in the blood of black bodies. And so that's what I mean by that type of experience. I was like, what am I looking at? You know, as I'm here, in here, looking at all of this, I'm like, what am I looking at? And that's why I ended up talking about the history, a history, not the history, a history of white supremacy in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else do you talk about in your book? I was thinking about, you know, you talk about, you know, the black body. You talk about, you know, there's a history of how black people have...
Well, not really the black body, but that was an example. But, yeah, I do give my history and understanding of white supremacy from the foundings of this country. I also, of course, talk about the way I give an analysis of what I think the media did, my analysis of what I thought happened in the trial and what should have happened in the trial. I give an explication of involuntary manslaughter, and first-degree felony murder, which I thought was the more fitting charge that should have been slapped on Meserle and Peroni, because Peroni did not face criminal trial. He has never faced trial for his role in the murder of Oscar Grant like he should, because he created the entire situation that set up and led to Oscar's murder. But I also recreate, to the best of my ability, what happened on the Fruitvale train station platform that early morning. And so in my writing, I attempt to take the reader there. If they didn't see the movie, if they didn't see the YouTube video of Oscar's murder, I try to paint a picture for it in their mind through my writing in the very first chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I want to go back to the soul murder of the community, because when you know, one of our sons or daughters is killed, and particularly when it becomes really high profile, which means that it's, you know, we're over and inundated and saturated with it over and over and over again. So we're being, you know, we're dying over and over again every time it shows up, you know, on the screen or in an article or in other you know, types of forms, you know, formats, you know, we relive it because you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, there is no justice, and these type of things happen over and over again. I was just wondering, sort of, how does one recover from such an experience? Like, to be in that court room, how long did the trial last, and how does one recover from that? Because life is never the same after that. I mean, what you know, what you've experienced, is something that you can't ignore, and it sort of alters maybe, you know, sort of your direction, or to a certain degree, I would presume, you know, in the work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, the process of writing the book was helping me to figure out what it was I had witnessed. I knew what I had witnessed, but I didn't know, you know, why certain things were going on. So the process of writing the book was helpful, which is probably, I think, the reason why it took so long. Well, not so much because of that. There was, you know, every writer has internal doubts in what I call internal sabotage. So that's part of the reason why it took me like 4 years to write this book. For a one-month trial, you know, in addition to the process of life going on. But I probably should have had a good spiritual cleansing after coming out of that courtroom, and I didn't. So that might have added to the length of time also. There were stretches when I did not write about the book for months at a time, but I thought about it every day. So it's been with me from that time period. You know, writers are supposed to write every single day. I wouldn't do that, but I was thinking about it every single day. I was thinking about what I was going to write, how I was going to write it, if I needed to rewrite something else, if there was a piece missing that I needed to get. So I was constantly writing in my head about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So was the process of writing sort of a way that you – I mean, you didn't have a spiritual cleansing per se, but would you say that the writing, getting this out, served a similar purpose?
I'd say it did now. At the time, it was kind of painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the time, it was a little bit painful at the time, but I knew I had to do it. I knew I had to do it. I was doubtful I could do it. And so, you know, again, that's that whole writer's doubt where you go back and forth and you walk away and you come back and you walk away and you come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this a first book for you or not?
Yep. This is the very first book.
Wow. Wow. What a first book.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to be doing a reading in, we had wanted to do one in Oakland, but I wasn't able to get there. And by the time I was able to get there, which is next week, the venue was not able to host it. So we're going to be at La Pena next Wednesday at 7 p.m. And then I'm going to go, after the Malcolm X Festival, I'm going to go over to the Green Arcade on Sunday at 5 p.m. I was attempting to work something out with Marcus Bookstores, but we weren't able to work it out. And then I found out the other day what happened there. So,
Marcus in San Francisco is closing.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping to get there before they closed. I knew they had been in trouble. I was hoping to get there, praying for them to hold on, not just for me, but for the community. But it wasn't to be. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So. So I was wondering, if you could maybe talk. You talked a little bit about the process that you had the self doubt, and maybe is that why the title is what it is?
No. That had nothing to do with the title. The self doubt was more of taking so long to do the book. At one point, I was like, "Oh my God, I got to get this book out of me. Please let me get this book out of me." So.
Yeah. And then sort of thinking about sort of the energy of Oscar, his spirit and spirit of the ancestors, of other stories like this that people maybe, are not reading anymore, but his story is not a story that doesn't have a historical context. And so I was wondering, do you feel... Did you feel Oscar's presence with you at all? Was he in the court? Was he in your office or in your when you were writing the book? Like,
He was in my head.
Was he writing the book through you?
I think. Well, I didn't feel him channeling me like that, but I definitely felt he was in the background like, that's what I was trying to tell you. That's what happened. You see what they did? Yeah, you got to tell this story. It wasn't very overbearing, but I definitely think that he has helped me through this point. Now, interestingly enough, when I was in the courtroom, I actually got a cold one day, and I missed about 2 days of the trial. And part of it, I don't know if you know, I'm sure it's probably the same elsewhere, but again, I haven't covered criminal trials before. But in the courtroom where I was, it was very cold in that courtroom. And I surmise, I didn't ask anyone, but, certain areas, certain places, hospital waiting rooms, jails, they keep them very, very cold to keep down on germs. And what I was feeling in that courtroom was germs, actually. So there was the cold, but there's just, all the black bodies that have come through there, all that negative energy. And then I'm in this particular trial with Meserle's defense team. His family is over there. You've got spectators. And it was just, the day after I got sick, I just had to stay there and recuperate. It was right around the time where Meserle's attorney was making his final summations, and it started out, well, Meserle's attorney, Michael Raines, when he made his opening remarks to the jury, he was very, very confident, very, very, very gung-ho, and this was before the prosecuting attorney, who I also mentioned briefly in the book, demolished Meserle on the witness stand. And so when we get to the final arguments, it was almost as if there really wasn't an argument he was making. He was just pleading for this good white man's life. And again, like I said, I was recuperating from a cold. I was like, I'm not going back to hear him beg. I just can't do it. I just couldn't get out of the bed that day. Mm-hmm. I need to be there. This is historic. I can't do it. I can't get out of bed. I can't. But, yeah, in terms of prosecutors, the word prosecute and persecute come from the same Latin root, which means to follow or to pursue. And so I argue that those who have historically pursued African people really can't be trusted to exact justice on behalf of African people, not that much. But one thing that I did see, I have to, you know, give credit where credit is due, that the prosecutor, he wasn't vigorous, in my opinion, enough in his prosecution, but he did point out the inconsistencies in what I just call the general craziness of Meserly's assertion that he meant to pull his taser and not his gun. And he talked, Meserly talked about it, he thought that Oscar Grant was going for a gun. He couldn't get his arm out from beneath him. He couldn't get Oscar Grant's arm out from beneath him. He thought he was reaching into his pocket to get a gun. And the prosecutor was explaining, well, you know, you've had training on tasing people before. You know about involuntary movements. You know about how the muscles contract, lock up. Why would you tase someone who might have their hand around a gun? And you said that you didn't know where your partner, Anthony Peroni, was. You weren't aware of your surroundings. Isn't that one of the first rules of firearm safety, to know your target and what's beyond it? Why would you risk getting off of Oscar Grant in order to place room between you and him so you can tase him? If you thought his hand was on a gun, why would you risk getting off of him so he could pull out that gun and possibly shoot you, your partner, or the bullet ricochet and hit somebody on the BART platform? So it showed how Meserly's testimony was rehearsed. And I understand it's not unusual or immoral for a defendant in a criminal trial to go over their testimony with their legal team, but Meserly's was rehearsed on focusing on intending to pull the taser and focusing away from pulling his gun. So it was so rehearsed to the fact that his answers made no sense to the questions the district attorney was asking him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, going back to the temperature in the courtroom, I went to the hearings in San Francisco for the San Francisco 8, and you know, seeing those brothers come in shackles just sort of took me back to the plantation.
Yep.
That I haven't experienced, you know, personally, but, you know, sort of our ancestors experienced it. I'm like, oh, my goodness. I mean, they were like hands, wrists,
weight,
ankles,
hands, wrists, waist, ankles.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, like, where do they expect them to go? So, you know, these experiences, and then for them to outright, just in case you had any doubt, oh yeah, the KKK, they're sitting here with us as well. You know, philosophically, and like, you know, it's like they're, you know, sort of any idea you might have had that justice was going to happen just sort of, you know, evaporated right then in that moment. Yeah, and just sort of the boldness of this miscarriage of justice for, you know, for Oscar Grant, you know, and for the other Oscar Grants historically and to come, you know, in the present. You mentioned that you're going to cover one of two cases this year.
Well, that's my hope. That's my plan. It's not definite yet.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, and I was just wondering, sort of in the courtroom, how many black reporters were there? You know, sort of the kind of mindset you are, you know, representative of.
Well, Charlene Muhammad was the West Coast correspondent for the Final Call. She was there throughout much of the trial. A young man by the name of Alex Alonzo, he's the person behind the website streetgangs.com, he was there for a good portion of the trial. And that was it. There was a young man by the name of Anya Howell who had been there for youth radio, but he ended up being kicked out of the trial because he was charging one of his electrical devices in the courtroom, and the judge had specified absolutely no recording whatsoever, no audio, no video recording. And a bailiff saw his recording device and arrested him, and he was charged with contempt. He was subsequently able to convince him that he was not recording, and I don't believe that he was, because we all took it very seriously not to record because we didn't want to get kicked out. But after that experience, he did not return. So in terms of black folks there, I saw a guy maybe one day from a Northern California station. I don't even remember his name or what he looked like. But that was it in terms of black folks.
Yeah. did you all, I mean, do you feel a sense of, I mean, did you feel like a sense of support, like sort of circling the wagon, so to speak? You know, you all had each other's backs.
Well, you know, a lot of the reporters that were there were from Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy there from the L.A. Times. Other than that, you know, me, Alex, and Charlene, we were from L.A., so it didn't feel hostile in terms of being a reporter.
Okay.
That part didn't feel hostile at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not to me, it didn't. I don't know what they were thinking, but I didn't feel that.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. So tell us about your future plans.
Well, like I say, if I'm lucky, I am looking into covering the trial of Ted Wafer. This is the man charged in the murder of Renisha McBride in Detroit, Michigan. Renisha had been out partying earlier in the afternoon, in the evening, and ended up crashing her car on the way home. We're not sure what happened to her for a good chunk of time. She had wandered away from the accident. Witnesses said that they saw her bleeding from the head. She eventually ends up on Ted Wafer's porch, knocking on his door for assistance. He said that someone was banging on the door. His story is that he thought someone was attempting to break in, so he opened the door and let off one shotgun blast, killing Renisha McBride. He's been charged with second-degree murder, or perhaps manslaughter. I'm not sure. I have to check back on that. But his trial is scheduled for July in Detroit. And I'm thinking about going to cover that trial. There's also a trial here in Los Angeles. A woman by the name of Alicia Thomas left her children at a police station about 2 years ago, saying she could not care for them. Police were dispatched to her home once they were able to ascertain, you know, the mother of these children, where she lived. They went to her home to question her, and they ended up arresting her for abandoning her children. She was combative with them, they say. And as they tried to get her into the police car, she was struggling. A female police officer by the name of Mary O'Callaghan was heard stating that if she did not calm down, she was going to be kicked in her genital area. And according to the witness, who was another officer, Mary O'Callaghan went through on her threat. The autopsy report states that she kicked her 7 times in her vaginal area. Mary O'Callaghan says that she was using her foot to push her into the car because Alicia Thomas was so combative. She was hanging out the car, wouldn't get in the car. So Mary O'Callaghan is shoving her in the car using her foot. And we haven't seen the video yet, but there was video in the back of the car where it talks about Alicia Thomas was saying, complaining she couldn't breathe. She went unconscious, and she ended up dying. And so that officer has been charged with abuse under color of authority. Her trial should be starting late summer, early fall this year. And so when it comes to the murder of black women by police, by white supremacy, our numbers are not as not the same as black men. So we don't see it as a big crime, something we should rally around, but it does happen. It doesn't happen as often, but it does happen. And the story, just like the story of Oscar Grant's death is an integral part of the story of his life, the same for Renisha McBride and for Alicia Thomas. One, because that, you know, black women's stories are not told, and again, because of what I just said, when we're the victims of white supremacist murder, it's not seen, because it doesn't happen that often. We almost don't know what to think about it, what to make of it. But these women were most definitely the victims of white supremacist murder, and their stories need to be told. And we need to look at how white supremacist murder, how police terrorism affects black women, because it does affect us. Again, it's just not to the same degree, the same numbers that it affects black men. So that's a project I'm hoping to take on later this year.
Yeah. I was wondering, just thinking about, you know, our new Attorney General of the state of California, you know, Kamala Harris, and, you know, one would think that, you know, because, you know, she is, you know, biracial woman, you know, African and Indian, South Asian, that, you know, we might see some attention to, you know, the state's response to violence against women, state-sponsored violence against women. I'm thinking about, you know, sort of the rate of incarceration of women here in our state, and the overpopulation, you know, of the prisons. The majority of the women doing really long time for nonviolent offenses. There was an event here in Northern California where victims of police violence were protesting outside of her office here in Oakland, and there was one case of a young woman who had been killed. She had mental illness, and she was killed by the Berkeley police. They actually smothered her, and it sounds really similarly horrific, you know, that this young woman was, you know, beaten to death. I'm like, Yeah. And now with all these cameras, you know, police have cameras filming everything, and, you know, and citizens were already filming things. People don't even care that they're being documented.
No. Well, it depends on where you are. We had a story came out in the L.A. Times a couple of weeks ago that in one area of South L.A., one of the housing projects, it was either Nickerson Gardens or I think it was Nickerson Gardens, they had the police department had done a study. Their auditor found out that one particular precinct, which covers that area, like all of the cars, and I mean all of the squad cars, had disabled the antenna so that their cameras would not work on the cars. Not one or two officers, every car, the antenna had been disabled. Every single car. So we talk about, you know, the need for these measures, dash cam video cameras that the officers can wear on them, which are needed and which are necessary. But if those individual officers have the way to disable it, they will do it. And once again, we're left with no recourse, allegedly. Allegedly,
wow.
We are left with no recourse.
Interesting. Wow, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something. So how do you afford to travel and cover these types of trials and, you know, write these books and do these kind of stories? Is it from your work at Pacifica or?
Well, now you know I haven't traveled anywhere for a trial just yet. I crowdfunded the book, and so I intend to do that with the Detroit trip for Renisha McBride. And I also intend to do it with the. I still intend to do it with the trial of Alicia Thomas if I do that one, because I like the idea of having the transcripts. I'm there and I'm actually taking notes and I'm witnessing it, but being able to fall back on the exact words, the transcript, in case I might get the quote wrong. And so transcripts can be very, very expensive. So there's going to be a need to fundraise for that. But part of the long process in terms of or should I say the delay in writing this book on Oscar Grant was, you know, fretting over, I need a job, I need to work, I ain't got time to be writing. So 4 years ago, I had absolutely no clue as to how I would get to this point. Now I look back and I see how I was able to get over. It was a combination of the material world and spiritual world, that's all I can say. I know a lot of people don't believe in the spiritual world, I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way this book got written. That's how this book got written.
So you mentioned, you know, a few of our ancestors. Ida B. Wells just mentioned, you know, with regards to this program you started, and you also mentioned, you know, Sojourner Truth and Celia, a slave. And I'm wondering, so who are you channeling? You know, what energies are you channeling?
Well, no, Sojourner and Celia, I wasn't mentioning them in terms of, they're not mentioned in this book. That was just a conversation I was having with you. But Ida B. Wells is my girl. We ride together. That's my homie right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a remarkable woman. My goodness. She
remarkable.
Was doing so much. And yeah, it's just amazing. You know, one of the founders of the NAACP, you know, she documented all of these lynchings. I mean, she was a real crusader. And, you know, the lone woman in these assemblies of black men, and, you know, among them, and some with some big egos like W.B. Du Bois, and you know, and she just, you know, she just sort of knew how to choose her battles and do the work. And I'm just wondering, what, you know, sort of, she's like such a great model of teamwork. I mean, I wonder who her husband was, because, you know, we don't know her husband per se, but he must have been really just a really wonderful man to be so supportive. Yeah, he was very supportive of her.
When she had her first child, she said, basically, I'm going to retire now to be a mom, and people were telling her, you can't, you got to get out of here, He was able to secure for her a nanny for her to travel. You know, her husband was a businessman. He operated a newspaper. He was also a few years older than her. So at that time in Illinois, well, not so much that time in Illinois, but at that time period, he was also a Republican, and I believe he was either running for office or held some type of local office. So around that time period, when Ida B. Wells was married, was around 1892, black people were Republicans, and it didn't raise an eyebrow the way it does today. And because, you know, the Republican Party of that time period seemed more akin to the Democratic Party of today. And that was also the party of Lincoln, the party that talked about free land, free labor, free men. And so back then it made sense for black folks to be Republicans. We didn't come over to the Democratic Party until the New Deal started happening and after the stock market crash. So at that time period, he was connected in the Republican Party. He had a little, you know, a little bit of cheddar. Not a whole lot, but a little bit, you know. And he liked the fire in Ida B. Wells, and they were working together, and he proposed, and that's how they got married. But it was a partnership. He supported her and had her back every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, definitely. And such a good model. People don't you know, don't always look at the full picture when one looks at, you know, her life, how she was able to do what she did. Because, you know, she had some support, you know, from her husband, because she was also a mother, and, you know,
she had four children.
Yeah, and you can't do your work if your children aren't taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We know how hard it is for sisters with one. She had four, so she could only have done that work if he was supportive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful woman. Yeah, wonderful woman to have on your side too, sister.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah. I just love, you know, Sister Sojourner, you know, and for her, you know, for her work, you know, strong, tall, imposing, physically imposing woman, who really pushed through these circles where black women were not present. And you couldn't ignore her either. I mean, dark, beautiful, statuesque, also a mother, you know, and she had lost her children, you know, during enslavement, I believe. And then Celia, I don't know Celia's name per se.
Yeah, that was a book that I was familiar with the title, but I had never read the book. I came across that book when I was doing research on Renisha and Alicia Thomas and how black women are affected by state-sanctioned violence. Celia was a slave. Let's see, was it Missouri? See, I can't remember now. information starts colliding in my head. But she was a slave somewhere. And she was raped by her master. She killed her master. She was put on trial, and part of the jury instructions from the judge did not include allowing her to defend herself as a woman because she was not seen as a woman. And so one of the things I was researching that because, you know, you have Renisha McBride, who was like five. She was maybe 5'6". I think she was 5'5". She was short.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was late at night, and, you know, you don't see a woman on your porch. Ted Wafer, that is, you see an intruder. You don't take the time to find out what it is you're looking at, literally and figuratively, physically. And so, you know, she gets shot in the face with a shotgun blast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're,
yeah.
And so on the one hand, you know, you we're not seen as women, but on the other hand, you know, you have a police officer threatening to kick you in your genital area. Now, I'm sure that happens with men all the time, but I don't remember hearing about it in the paper. I don't remember hearing a cop say that another, I heard this cop say he was going to threaten to kick him in his genitals and then he followed through on the threat. I don't hear that all the time. That's not always reported.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's particular ways that black women suffer violence, and then we suffer violence because we're not seen as women. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a lot going on.
Sojourner Truth spoke, when she spoke, you know, at that conference of women around, you know, suffrage, you know, that they didn't see her as a woman.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, she was, you know, formerly property, and then she wasn't property anymore, but then she still wasn't a woman. Like, what do I have to do to be a woman? I have children, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm strong, okay, I'm, you know, not going to deny that. You might be strong, too, if you had, you know, if you were in a similar circumstances, but you don't have to be because you're white women. You know, but we're talking about the vote. We're talking about, you know, taking this country, you know, back because, or taking this country because, you know, the men are doing a good job with it. And then she ran into this sexism, you know, and racism, you know, combined in this assembly of women who are supposed to be some of the progressive women, you know, in this country at that time. And she had to just, like, hold up. And do that and tell them, you know, like, wait a minute. Ain't I a
mm-hmm.
woman? You know, and sort of really sort of change their perspective and open their minds to listen. Wow, yeah. Yeah, and, yeah, it's just really, really great work you're doing, and certainly I hope, you know, that the money continues to come so that you can do this work. I'm really, really interested in reading what you have to say about these two trials of these two women are kind of emblematic of, you know, lots of black women who have, you know, died, you know, sort of like this, but they weren't there. The circumstances were raised to like a national sort of kind of prominence, and so we don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really great that these two stories, you know, have been, you know, made it into the media, and be great to have you covering it because it'd be a different perspective, I'm sure, than you know, the corporate media might put out there.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
definitely going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So great that you're going to be coming out, you know, sort of on Malcolm X weekend, beginning this Wednesday. You're going to be hanging out in the San Francisco Bay Area for quite a bit of the week, Wednesday through Sunday. So you're going to come in to Berkeley May 14th, 7 to 9 at La Pena Culture Center, 3105 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley. That's going to be really exciting, and
I hope so.
yeah, you're sponsored by the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and Onyx, award-winning hip-hop journalist David D of KPFA's Hard Knock Radio. He's going to moderate,
and Uncle Bobby Cephas Johnson is scheduled to be there also. I don't know about Oscar's mom Wanda Johnson, but his Uncle Bobby will be there.
Oh, great. Yeah, we love Uncle Bobby. That's going to be really nice. And mm-hmm. and then on Sunday, the 18th at 5 o'clock, you're going to be at the Green Arcade Bookstore, really nice bookstore at 1680 Market Street in San Francisco. Do you have a website?
Yes, it's www.triplemurder.com.
Yeah, triplemurder.com. And you'll have copies of the book for people to buy there?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. Super. Okay, wonderful. Well, I'm looking forward to reading the book and to meeting you at one of these events. And, yeah, so until then, you know, safe travels, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, you take good care.
Okay, you too.
All right, peace and blessings.
Peace.
So we are going to close with Janis Joplin's Piece of My Heart.
But man, all of a sudden, somebody threw me in this rock and roll band, right, man? They threw these musicians at me, man, and the sound was coming from behind me. The bass was charging me. And I knew then and there that 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 was it. I never wanted to do anything else. And it was better than it had been with any man, you know. Like you were the only man. Yeah, didn't I give you nearly everything that a woman possibly can? Honey, you know I did. Each time I tell myself that I think I've had enough, but I'm gonna show you, baby, that a woman can be tough. I want you to come. Never hear me when I cry at a night, and when I cry all the time, each time I tell myself that I can't stand the pain. When you hold me in your arms, I'm singing once again. I say, come on, come on, come on, come on and take it. Take another little piece of my heart now, baby.
Break it.
Break another little.
Janis Joplin, Piece of My Heart from Janis Joplin, the musical.
The blues is so subtle.
trying to figure out what else I want to play. And I was thinking about Regina Carter's Jeru Nani, God be with you, from Reverse Thread. And that's beautiful. I think I might send it out to the mothers. And maybe I might play one more thing. But here's Regina Carter. Regina Carter, Jeru Nani, God be with you, from Reverse Thread. Thank you. So that was arranged by, that was Joyful Grace, arranged by Jacqueline Hairston. And just follow Ms. Hairston at the world premiere of Tawawa House at the Townsend Opera in Bakersfield? No. Was it Bakersfield? I'm trying to remember. Gosh, is that where we went last week? I'm trying to remember now. It might have been Bakersfield. It was far. But it was worth it. It was certainly worth the journey. And, yeah, it was really wonderful theater, huge, great turnout for the second and final performance in Modesto. Tripping. Bakersfield, that would be further than Modesto. Modesto was a drive. But we got there early when she had a chance to go to one of the museums walking distance from the lovely theater. Just wonderful, wonderful performance. And got a chance, like I said, to meet with, to see Ms. Hairston, who lives in Sacramento now, as well as Dr. Cecile Bibbs, who was also there that afternoon. It was simply marvelous. So I was thinking about Ms. Hairston. So I said, oh, there is some music from an interview we had September 16th, a while back. And so I think we're going to close with another one of Dr. Hairston's arrangements. And she is, I believe she was one of, she knows, knew quite a few people in the cast, among them Shanette Folker, who sang the lead role of Fanny. And I was thinking, I was thinking about soul well-being because of what our last guest, Tandi, mentioned with regards to the soul murder, you know, of the community. I was thinking, oh, well, maybe we can restore that, at least philosophically, on the show by playing the soul well-being. But then I really wanted to play Walk Close. So I'm going to end with both of these pieces, soul well-being and Walk Close. And thank you again so much for tuning in to another edition of Wanda's Picks. And tune in again on Wednesday. We're going to be out of town if I feel better. And so I will have a pre-recorded interview for you to listen to. We won't have a regular broadcast per se, but there will be something for you to listen to if you tune in and click on the play button. And then we'll be back live on Friday, the start of Malcolm X or Malcolm El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz weekend with the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival next week. Oh, my goodness, it's going to be so phenomenal. And that is, I'm trying to think, May, look on my calendar here. Let's see, next week is May 16th, and Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival is May 17th. So, again, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers and all the nurturers and providers for our children, and that includes men, because we have men who are definitely nurturing and taking care of our future, of our children. And sometimes our children are our sisters, sometimes they are our brothers, and sometimes they are our nieces and nephews. So happy Mother's Day to all of those who are doing that wonderful work and doing that important work. And so we're going to again end with Jacqueline Hairston's arrangement of Soul, Well-Being, and then Walk Close.